Heavenly Father, we thank you for having called us into the kingdom of your Son. We thank you for gathering us here as your people. We thank you for this time of worship together and fellowship and teaching, and pray that you might knit us together in Christian love. We pray that as we consider how we as Christians ought to conceive of the state and relate to it, that you would inspire us by your Holy Spirit. And so, Father, be with us in this teaching and in our conversations, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. I know most of you, but not all of you. My name is Father Charles Erlinson. I am the assistant rector at Good Shepherd Reformed Episcopal Church in Tyler, Texas. I teach at the school there, too, the Christian school, Good Shepherd Parish School, a variety of subjects. I also do a daily devotional. That's what the website is. It's at the top of the page. 10 years ago, exactly, I was in Hot Springs and decided that I didn't like any of the daily devotionals that were out there, so I wrote my own for every part of the New Testament. And there's a website that has a blog. You can read it, and I send it out if you get on the mailing list every day. I've also self-published 2 volumes, if you're interested in buying those, Matthew and Mark. And I stopped after that because there wasn't enough interest to continue it, but it's all there if you're interested in that, and I've got the website there. Now, we've come this morning to talk about the process of secularization. And I wanted you to leave this discussion with understanding 3 things. First of all, what secularization is and why it's important. Secondly, how did we get here? That's where I'm going to spend most of my time. And then third is, what can we do about it? It is good always to name a fear and understand it, because then you gain power over it. And I find that many Christians, for a long time now, at least 3 or 4 decades, have been very, I don't think scared is too harsh of a word to say, they've been scared, anxious, worried, fearful of the process of secularization, largely because we don't know how we got here. So I want to begin with the definition of secularization, talk about various theories, and then present kind of a developed theory of what I think is the best understanding of how we got here, even though it's a little complicated. First of all, what is secularism? What do you think is the popular understanding? What does that even mean? To say that we are in a secular world, that there is a process of secularization, or there's this thing called secular humanism, for example. What is that? Any impressions? Okay, separate from God.
It's a worldview without God.
Okay, a worldview without God. And it comes from a word that means world, so it's worldly, but then we have to define that, of course. And we as Christians are aware that the world around us, particularly I'm now speaking of American culture, what we're most familiar with, is becoming increasingly less Christian by any number of measures. And some of that is, in fact, most of it's rather impressionistic. Some of it is founded more on actual fact and reality. But there is a sense that the church is weak and that it's getting weaker, that there is an impending sense of doom, that persecution, this huge tidal wave of persecution is coming. Right now we're catching the first few drops, but the worst is coming. And pretty soon we're going to be deluged and drowned by it. And for some, not me personally, but it's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end times. Armageddon's around the corner. So is the rapture. Yada, yada, yada. All of that. We all know that. And I've grown up with that for 40 years. So if that's, the problem that we're kind of intuiting, what is it really? And then we'll talk about where we are, how we got here. The best definition is often a really short one. So I've chosen to define it as this way, that secularization is the erosion of religious institutions, beliefs, and practices. And those 3 things, institutions, beliefs, and practices, are good ways of looking at any religious identity. We tend to think of religion as being very individualistic and personal and interior, and that's only part of it. There is an institutional side to it, there's a belief system, and then there's actually practices. And when I did my PhD in Lancaster on Anglican identity, I used the model that was related to this. So where are we now? If there is indeed a process of secularization, that there was once a religious foundation to culture, in our context that means Christian, but it's eroded, where does that leave us? Where are we at in this process? Well, I'd like to begin with a famous quote. Some of you are very familiar, at least with the first part of it. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received for good or for evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. Now, where is that from? Most of you know. Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Willie knew that. Here's some handouts, girls. And his point is this, that at the time when this book is set, he's saying, it's not all or nothing. And I find that's very common to Christian thinking. And it's not just Christian, it's human thinking. It's very binary. It's this or it's that. It's kind of all or nothing. So the Christian founding of America was just the best period in all in history. And it was this golden age. And now it's the worst of times. And almost always, both things are true. It's not even that we're somewhere in the middle. It's somehow that both are true. This is one of the great things I learned by studying church history in such detail. If you look worldwide, at least, not in any one individual country, the church is always in decline and in crisis, and the church and the world are always being reformed and renewed by God. Both things are happening at the same time, often even within the same culture. So where are we in the United States? I think I share the widespread feeling of decline. I think there's a lot of truth to that. What are some symptoms or signs that things are going downhill in terms of Christianity in America? Let's start home, closest to home. What have you noticed? What gets your attention about that things really are turning for the worse? Yeah, specific. Okay, so we've got violence. What else?
The over-celebration of sinful choices.
Okay, that's kind of become front and center in many manifestations of that same issue of human sexuality and human identity. Any others? There's a lot, but just thought get any impressions before we moved on. That's it. That's pretty good. That's all we've got. Ongoing wars, right? You had your hand up in the back. Okay, yeah. So I mean, lifestyle issues. They're right. Yeah, there are many ways in which you can measure this. Some, you know, sometimes it's a clear picture, sometimes not. Just one example on that issue of homosexuality. If you look at public attitudes. From 2001 to 2016, this comes from the Pew Research Center, which is usually a pretty good, solid source of stats. In 2001, Americans opposed same-sex marriage, 57% opposed it. 2016, 15 years later, it's down to 35%. That's a pretty dramatic climb, and we can see that, we can sense that. That would explain why, even as recently, for example, as the early 90s, the Clintons, of all people, are out there promoting the Defense of Marriage Act. Now that the cultural times have changed, well, it's quite the opposite. So we've seen a precipitous decline in certain areas in recent years. We've seen most recently the rise of transgenderism, and it's been kind of startling to some of us, even if it's not necessarily unnerving or unexpected. It's still a little bit startling, the speed with which some of these things are happening, and it's a little bit bewildering. Not just that this is happening, but how and how quickly. Illegitimacy rates. Anybody want to take a guess about how high they are now? Just again, one small measure. 40%. No, this is nationally, across all demographics. 40%, but it's 75% in the black community. And we think that doesn't matter. 3 out of 4. What was it in 1940, national average, would you guess? If it's 40% now across all races and so on, 4%. So, 4%, 1 out of 25 to 40%, 2 out of every 5. And if that really makes a difference, and it does, then you can see how that's just one small measure. So, you know, things are in many ways getting worse. Church attendance is kind of a thorny one. The only reason I bring that up is because it's contrary to what we think. Church attendance, is it going up or down? It's going down slightly, but this is where history gets very interesting. Depends upon when you look at. We've come out of, in a sense, if there is a golden age, not really, but there is a golden age of church attendance. We're at the tail end of it, historically speaking, and I'm talking long-term history. In 1776, we just got done celebrating the 4th of July, 1776, that period, that golden age, right? I'm putting quotes around this if you're just listening to this, right? What was the church membership? Not people who claim to be Christians, that's a different number. How many were actually members of a local church in 1776? Take a wild guess. Any other guesses? He said 90%. 17%. 1 out of 6. There was a big upturn for reasons that Rodney Stark, I'll refer to him later, refers to in 1850s, up to 34%. 1890, 45%, 1906, 51%. From 1980 to 2000, 62%. So there's been a little bit of a retracement from that, but that's a historic high. In the Middle Ages, the actual church membership in many ways was much lower than we think. Puritan Massachusetts, right, that great bastion. I think this is the hardcore Christians, right? Church membership was what? We might think it's 100%, right? It's compulsory, right? 22%. So it's this unbroken line of things getting worse, right? Well, maybe not. The only reason I brought that stat up is because it shows us that it's not as simple as it looks, where things were perfect there and they're just completely miserable now. It's not that simple. How are we doing in Western Europe? I'm not going to spend much time on this, but just in general, things good there? No. That's my short answer. No. Now, things get more interesting because I'm interested in the whole world. I know I'm an American. God's put me here. I'm especially interested in America and Texas and Tyler because that's where God's planted me. But I'm interested in the world. How's Africa doing? It's just continuing to go with the same way. Oh, wait. How many Christians, and here I'm just going to use numbers, not the only stat, but how many African Christians, how many Christians in Africa in 1900 do you think? I love numbers, as you can tell. William. Wow, he's brilliant. Either that or he's been to my first lecture before. But it's good for you. You actually remembered it. 9 million. 1970. So we'll fast forward past 70 years. How many? 116 million. 2000. 357 million. 2012, just 12 years later, 487 million. That's pretty good. Now, they'd be the first to admit a lot of that Christianity is somewhat shallow. They need deeper roots, but there are new churches in many ways, right? So, this process of secularization is not even across the world. It's not happening everywhere across the world because, remember, it's a decline of religion, and there is a decline of African religion, but it's a decline of traditional religions, and it's the rise of Christianity. And that's a good thing, isn't it, for everybody? How about China? Anybody know about what's going on there? Communist China? Way up. Hard to get numbers, but approximately triangulating through a number of means, and this includes both the official three self-churches that's sponsored by the state, or at least accepted in all the underground churches, but through a variety of data, it looks like there's about 160 million. Makes it the third most Christian nation in the world, at least by numbers. Not by percentages, of course. The downside is that that's out of 1.3 billion Chinese, so it's not quite as glamorous as it seems, but still, more Christians in China than anywhere except the United States and Brazil. And the trend is up, continuing to be up. What happens when you get 300 million Christians in China? Things happen. I mean, doesn't this seem a little bit like the Roman Empire? But communism can never fall, right? It just seems impregnable in China. We've already seen it fall. Where? Soviet Union. Where's the trend in the Soviet Union? Up. Now, if you're a Protestant, it may not look so up because they are really kind of putting obstacles to entry there. But as far as the church as a whole, they're by and large up. In 1991, so at the tail end, the Soviet Empire, 61% of Russians were unaffiliated. That's a huge number. For this church that had been Russian Orthodox for 1,000 years to have in 70 years, down to 61% not being affiliated, meaning you're atheist. 31% Orthodox. Now, it's 18% unaffiliated and 72% Orthodox. So in 25 years, almost a total reversal. So you can go back and you can have what is called de-secularization. It gets pretty complicated because, as you can see, it's not just this one-size-fits-all trend. Well, now here's the gist of my talk. How did we get here? Because in knowing how we got here, we can learn from the past, and we can learn what our obligations and prognosis is for the future, and what our part in that is. Now, here is the original is secularization theory. So I've really spent a lot of time studying this, really the last 15 years on and off, but in earnest about the past 3 months or so. And there has been, since the 70s, what's called the secularization thesis. We all understand what's going on, but what is it? Well, the original view is this. Basically, the secularization is due primarily to the rise of the Enlightenment, which generated a rational worldview that's based on empirical standards of proof, scientific knowledge, and technological mastery of the universe. Well, how does that lead to secularization? Well, rationalism, and remember, this is was the going theory, it's still popular in some circles, is that rationalism tends to disprove the Bible and the Christian worldview, so Christianity is rather neutered by rationalism. Furthermore, not only does the rational worldview explain things better than the Christian religious worldview, but it seems to work out better for humanity. That is, that material progress seems in some way directly linked to the rise of secularism and rationalism. There is a link, but it's a much more complicated link than anybody would suspect. Therefore, the thesis goes religion is declining, and furthermore, is destined to attrition itself to death. It's going to be eventually a world without religion, is what many people have hoped for. This is the going view back in the 70s, but it has now been either discredited or radically revised, at least among those who study the sociology of religion. But it's still alive and kicking among atheists and among the new atheists. This is still what they expect. And they're always disappointed, I think, to find out that religion is not really dying at all. They're dumbfounded by it, because they assumed this is just this linear trend down, and at some point, you know, it's all going to vanish, and it's not happening, because they've got the wrong thesis. Not only are they wrong theologically, they just are not even reading the times correctly. Let me present two other theories before I get to the more complex one that I think does the best justice to what's really happened, and is most helpful to us as Christians. This first one is what's called the religious marketplace theory. It's the one that I was swayed for by years, really up until even recently. People may have heard me propagate this, and there's truth in it. There's truth in all these other theories, but not enough for me. At the bottom of my handout, I've given you a bibliography. If you want to get familiar with this particular theory, and it's a very useful book in many ways, it's Acts of Faith by Rodney Stark and Roger Fink, and it's very readable because it's filled with great information and data, and they very carefully state what their conclusions are and how they build one upon another. And what I thought was just fantastic, I'd like to see more books do, is at the end, in the appendix, they list all those propositions and claims in order, so you can get a real summary of the whole argument. And this is basically the culmination of 35 years of work of Rodney Stark. So it's a great work to understand certain aspects of really how religions work. So it's called the religious marketplace theory because the idea is that religions are in a kind of competition as are people in a free market economy. And it's based on what we might call a supply side of religion, because their view is that demand is always the same. People are inherently religious, so that never changes. What changes is what it looks like. And I think there is some truth in that. Being made in the image of God, man is inherently religious. So it is true that even atheism has certain characteristics of being a religion for certain people. It's hard to define religion sometimes, but we're inherently religious. We're going to worship something. It also reverses the older view, the first view I expressed, by saying that religious competition, religious pluralism, actually, they say, is a good thing. Because where you have competition, those religions that are in some sense more successful or better in some ways thrive, and those who are deficient in some way in meeting human needs, they kind of wither away. Again, there's some truth in that, but it's not the best explanation. Furthermore, they would say, and this is relevant to our whole theme of the conference, they would say that state churches often lead to weak churches and weak Christians. Now, why might that be? Let's stop and talk about that for just a minute. It's really, I think, highly controversial, but it's and it's complex, but why might it be the case that having a state religion, the religion very tightly tied to the state, might be a weakening effect on the church? Michael?
Citizens can come to assume that just because they're part of that nationality, they're part of that church, they're part of that religion, regardless of their actual spiritual activity.
Now, that would never happen in America, right, where we have freedom of religion and a separation of church. Has that ever happened here?
Yes.
Where? How about the South, right?
Yeah.
You're a Christian, right? Not any longer. It used to be until pretty recently. Right? You come here, you just assume. Right? You just assume we're all Christians here, right? You assume if you're an American, you're a Christian.
in Croatia. We assume what, Michael? Most people, to be Croatian is to be a... And which kind? Roman Catholic, 93%. So to be a Croatian is to be a Roman Catholic. It's just discerned. Any other ways in which that close association or a state church might weaken the church? What's that? Okay, and what does that mean? Right, no competition. What does that do, let's say, to clergy, for example? I don't have to compete for my job. I'm just... You get lazy, and in fact, this does happen. It's not by any means the only picture. But you get people who get appointed to positions because I can buy my way into their simony historically in the church, or I know somebody. If you're in England up until pretty recently, and you're the second, third, fourth son, first son gets what? He gets everything, right? Second son gets what? Bupkis, he gets nothing, right? So what does he do? Becomes a lawyer or a priest. Now there's many opportunities, right? We don't even hold to that system. So you get into the priesthood because it's an easy living. And especially if you can find the right gig, right? You find the right little chapel that this priest has, or some rich person just wants you to say a mass every day for his dear departed parents. And that's your only thing. That's all you got to do. The rest of the time is yours. We've all seen various BBC productions and movies of things like Jane Austen. How do the clergy... These are the real go-getters, the wisest, brightest, most moral, excellent people. And she's not just caricaturing them. There was a lot of this. There would be priests who would show up in fox hunting uniforms. Was this some new liturgical garb they're wearing? Or no, they're watching the clock, they can't wait to get out to go fox hunting in the early 19th century. So there are those dangers. They would also say, and I think they're incorrect in this, that there was never really an age of faith. I think they're right to point out that those ages we look at where things seem perfect are far from it. People are not nearly as dedicated to the religion as they might seem to be. So they're right about that, but they're wrong about saying the Middle Ages, for example, that it wasn't a highly Christianized culture. It was. So they get some parts of that right, but not others. And just because there's only 17% membership in colonial America doesn't mean that it's not a highly Christianized culture in many, many ways. So they're wrong on that, but they're right on some things. The next theory is coming from a book called Sacred and Secular. It's a more recent one that is kind of a sort of a leading contender. People have kind of fled to this in denial of the previous one. And it's got, as we'll see again, some value. And it says this. It starts with the religious values hypothesis, which not only they would say is true psychologically for individual people, but socially and theologically. That growing up in less secure societies will heighten religious values. That is, if you're in poverty and need, if life is really, as Thomas Hobbes described it, as short, nasty, and brutish, you're more likely to turn to religion. If things are really good, you might be more reliant upon yourself. And so secure conditions will lessen religious impulse. There's some truth in that. We see that even in the Old Testament, don't we, in some cases. Where? Where in the Old Testament does this model play itself out? Where when things are secure and good, God gets forgotten. When things are desperate, people turn to God. Michael? The garden? It's Israel. Isn't it constantly? They're constantly doing this, right? Read the book of Judges. Read the same. And this is what they're doing all the time. So, some truth in it again. They break this down into what they call, furthermore, the demographic hypothesis. Demographic is on trends of birth and death and different age groups and so on. And they say this, that rich, secular societies, Western world today, we tend to produce fewer people. But we invest more each because we have more resources to do that. So we have fewer children, more wealth, and we can invest more. We can give our children more opportunities, protect them in more ways, and so on. On the other hand, poorer traditional societies tend to have a lot more children, but invest less in each one. Not only do they have fewer resources, they have more children. In the Middle Ages, for example, you would often have very, very large families. Or at least, let me put it this way. You'd have large, large numbers of children. But 40% of them wouldn't survive past age 10. And then those that aren't picked off by that are picked off often later by wars or disease. And in the Black Death, you get about a third of Europe just wiped out in a very short time. So in those societies, the theory is that you produce lots of children. This is their way of explaining how is it then that if the world keeps getting richer and more modernized and industrialized, which it does, how is it that religion still keeps perpetuating itself? Shouldn't it be that it's a complete downward trend? They're really good at realizing that that's not the case. So they explain it this way. Well, the rich countries that are becoming less religious are having fewer children. So there's fewer atheists because they don't propagate themselves very well. Homosexuals don't propagate themselves very well at all. There's just, if you need me to explain that, talk to me later. But it's but those who are religious, and that is perhaps in poor, more stressed conditions, they have a lot more children. So they keep producing more. Now, at some point, I guess this theory might say, well, the world gets rich enough that, again, the trend's going to be downward. And the fact is that there's some interesting evidence that by somewhere around 2050, the real problem of population will not be the population explosion that we heard about all in the 60s and 70s, but depopulation. Because actually, population is a good thing. Man is, made in the image of God, is the creator of wealth. The real wealth is in human beings. So you get rid of people, and you get rid of wealth, and you get rid of creativity and all of these things. It doesn't mean that there can't be stresses on population, of course, but then when you start depopulating, watch out. And not only is the Western world depopulated itself, so that Europe has a negative growth rate without immigration. The U.S. is slightly below replenishment without immigration. With immigration, we're still increasing in population. But even those places that had these extraordinary growth rates in the 60s and 70s have slowed down dramatically from about a 6% growth rate to more like 2 and 3. And 2.1 is replenishment. So it's slowed down dramatically. And there's evidence it might go backwards. If it does, then it's a completely different world from what they've been telling us. Well, let me get to what I think is the best understanding. Most of this is my own thoughts mixed with the work of a man named Brad Gregory, in particular a work called The Unintended Reformation. I came across Brad Gregory when I listened to his History of Christianity in the Reformation Era, which was a CD audiobook done by The Great Courses. And I was struck by a couple of things. I was struck by how much sense he made. I was struck by how favorable he was towards religion. That is, he said, look, if I'm studying the Reformation, then we need to get inside their own mindset. Let's not bring in our own atheistic secular prejudices. Let's let them speak for themselves. And even though I believe he comes from a Roman Catholic background, he was very even-handed about three kinds of Reformation. So I thought he was very reasonable. I knew he had written this book. I picked it up, and I was just really enthralled with it. However, because he is a Roman Catholic, there's one main thing that I would have with it if you do pick it up. It's a big book, it's difficult, but if you're interested in this and all, it's probably the best place to start. That is that he's willing to acknowledge that the Roman Catholic Church had some mistakes, in fact, really serious moral failings. In fact, he says that's kind of a lot of how we got here, is the moral failings of Christians. But he's unwilling to acknowledge the theological, institutional errors as well. Being a Roman Catholic, he just can't go there. I think if you leave that out, you miss a big part of the picture. Having said that, though, what he's done is to really produce what I think is the best, most comprehensive understanding of how we got here. And that means it's the best place to start for us to understand how to move forward. How do we get here? How do we meet these challenges? What is our part in this? He's really a good historian, and he understands the complexities of how history works, and he's got a whole introductory chapter on that. So if you're interested in how to do history and how to keep in your head at the same time a lot of countervailing trends, he's really good at that. And he's laid out, the book is structured according to six what he calls narratives that are intertwined. He deals with them all separately because it's the only way to really get at them. But he's quite conscious that they're all very much interrelated in ways that he can't really tell you in one book. So those are written for you, and I'm going to go through each one of those now. First of all is what he calls the change in the relationship or the view of the relationship between the Creator and the creation. This is the part of what I would call desacramentalization. That is, that the reason why the world seems secular, the reason why it seems like God has left the building, is because we've taken him out of the world. He hasn't gone anywhere. But the way we perceive God, the way we perceive his relationship to the world, means that we're not likely to see him. And I think that's true for a lot of the modern church as well. Now, how did this happen? Well, one way it happened is that the traditional view is that God is highly involved in his creation. He participates in his creation participates in him. It's what's called a sacramental or an analogical worldview. There's a close relation, and yet, in spite of that close relationship, God is utterly other, completely transcendent. And that's exactly what we expect of God, transcendent and immanent, and we without confusion, sort of like with the Trinity or the Incarnation. But beginning with late scholastic medieval theology, and this is where it gets interesting. So notice how far back this problem starts. We're talking about 14th century. That's a long time ago, and it's before the Reformation, so you can't just put it all at the feet of the Reformation. It begins with scholastic medieval theology, just to take two examples. One is the philosopher Duns Scotus, D-U-N-S, But it is from where we get the word dunce. I like that, those historical things. So dunce, because not a lot of people did not think highly of some of his philosophy, obviously. So how would you like to go down in history having that name, you know, be, hey, I'm really famous, but yeah, but because I'm a dunce. And this concept of univocity, it's kind of difficult, but it's this idea, it's all related to discussions of the nature of being. And it comes down to this, that instead of God and creation, including humans being different, vastly different kinds of things, he lumped them all together into the category of being. They have the same kind of being, but maybe just in different degrees. And in doing that, you begin to erase the distinction between God and his creation in some ways, and in other ways, you kind of end up exaggerating it too much. So it begins to diminish God. It obscures the dissimilarity between the creator and the creation, because now you've reduced it all to a philosophical category. And under scholasticism, too, you start getting a lot of philosophy intermingled with theology. And when you begin to do theology through philosophy, it's not that it shouldn't have some part to play, but when you do it too much through philosophy and you use philosophical categories instead of doing a more biblical theology, you usually end up somewhere you don't want to be a couple hundred years later. The second one is nominalism. This is William of Ockham, famous for Ockham's razor, which some of you might know. And these two are related, but the idea of nominalism is that, again, there's no inherent connection between the creator and the creation. When God does something, he does it rather arbitrarily, not because there's this intrinsic connection between God's love and his goodness and his beauty and that of the world. It's just because he ordains it to be so. And nominalism comes from the idea, comes from a Latin word for name, that names really don't have any inherent meaning. Now, in the Bible, do names have any meaning? Are they rather arbitrary? They do, and I chose my children's names very carefully, often because they had meaning precisely. We believe that names and words have no meaning. That's at the heart of deconstruction, if you know that philosophical and literary theory. Words have no inherent meaning, so we can make them mean what we want. Humans have no inherent meaning, so you can be whoever you want to be literally. It all comes from the same kind of philosophy. Now, this is not what William Ockham had in mind, but nominalism leads to that. This disassociation between God and creation, between the name and the thing it represents. And you'll understand, if you know what a sacrament is, right, that it breaks that sacramental bond between the thing that's signified and the thing and the signifier. Well, the second narrative is this. And this is where we might start with the Reformation. But even that has deeper roots, is the turn to the Bible alone and reason alone. Now, by Scripture alone or the Bible alone, we don't mean what the early Reformers meant by that. What I mean by that, what he means by that, is the idea that that's the only authority. We're not talking about, is it the ultimate or most important authority, or the only infallible authority. We're talking about, is it the only one? Why is it that for the Christian, the Scriptures cannot be the only authority, even if it's the highest? There's a little problem with that. What happens if, for example, I said, let's all pull out our Bibles and let's all figure out the meaning of this passage, but you can't rely upon anything except what you believe it means? What happens?
You're setting up your interpretation of the Bible.
Okay, and what if I disagree with you? Then what?
That's a problem.
That's a problem. How does it get resolved?
Start your church.
Arm wrestle? Just, you know, rock, paper, scissors. What did you say?
Start
your own church. So it doesn't work well. How this happens is that after the Reformation in the West, you know, you already have the East-West, but at least in the West and the East, things are relatively unified. You've got one church, but now when you have the Reformation, and everybody's claiming to believe the Bible, but you've got different authorities, and they're at each other's throats, it destabilizes the Christian church. It fragments it, and that process has continued for some time. It's not just as if there's now two groups, Protestants and Roman Catholics. From the beginning, there's many, many Reformed groups. And a lot of them are pretty small and very fringe and almost heretical, some of the radical reformers. So you set up these competing truth claims. Everyone says, I'm a Christian. Everyone says, I believe in the Bible. But you've got many different versions in really important ways, too, in very impractical ways. Furthermore, this leads to religious wars, culminating in the 30 Years' War, probably the most devastating war in European history aside from World War I. Because it's not just a matter of the number of people that died or the horrible things that happened. It's in Christians against each other just doing these absolutely horrible things. Just incredibly bad torture. Look up the word Schwedentrunk if you want to see some of these really bad tortures they did, William. I'll tell you about that later, but it's horrible. And Christians are doing this to each other, yes.
Is this concept related to
Well, it is in the sense that that it sounds the same, except that when they say sola scriptura, the early reformers, they're never saying that it's the Bible only by itself. They're saying that it's unique in some ways as far as its authority, but it gets perverted into this idea of the Bible alone and just me. That's not what they meant. So I want to be, thanks for that, because I want to be clear about that. So the early reformers are not culpable for that misunderstanding, but it has devolved into that in many ways. So you get the 30 Years' War, and it shatters this kind of faith in Christendom, in unity. Not only at a practical level, but at a theological and even psychological level, that Christians are just at each other's throats. How can we resolve these differences since the church is no longer capable of doing it? Which church is going to do that? Councils failed. That was the great hope. Conciliar movement, it failed. Didn't even get off the ground. So there's a turn towards human reason. Human reason, which seems to have discovered that unlock the mysteries of the universe in terms of a heliocentric theory of the solar system, in terms of laws of gravity, and in terms of producing a rational society that produced material benefits for people and lifted people out of poverty and so on. It really seems as if reason was doing a better job than the church. So reason became the arbiter of truth. Now the people saying this are almost all Christians. There's only a few wise guys out there like Spinoza and the people like Voltaire who are really not Christians. So it's Christians articulating the turn towards reason. They're not denying the scriptures, they're not denying the church, they're just saying this is, we have to do it on a rational basis. This happened at the same time that it looked as if science and reason were making these astounding gains, and so there was an inability to distinguish between what science is really good at, that is, technological advances and understanding how God's creation works, and what it's not good at. Science is terrible at philosophy and theology because it has nothing to say to it. Science can't tell you how the universe began because it's not replicable, it's not observable, it's just not verifiable. So there's all sorts of theories, but and there's still to this day a confusion between science and scientism. Third is the changing church-state relationships, which is, again, the theme of this conference. Now, for centuries and centuries, Christians have the view of Christendom that the Christian church and state are part of the same thing. Exactly how this worked may look different in different countries, which one really had more of the power. They went back and forth for centuries. But at the end of the late medieval period, you have the rise of the nation state for a variety of reasons. You have an increasing centralization of power as Europe kind of pulls herself together, and the state begins to assert authority over the church more and more, even in the medieval period, long before the Reformation. At the same time, the church continues to do things to discredit herself. There are all sorts of, you have the worst papacies during this period. The most worldly, godless people in the world are the Italian popes for like two centuries. And this is supposed to be the vicar of Christ. You have the discovery of the fact that a lot of what papal claims were based on forgeries. So there's outright lie, there's simony, there's buying of office. There are cardinals who are being made cardinals in the church, in the Roman Catholic Church at age 7 because they're somebody's nephew, so it's truly nepotism. I mean, it's just on, and people see this. To make it worse, there are at one point, there are three popes. And the papacy's in Avignon. You have 7 years of the Babylonian captivity. So all this is happening at the same time, and the church seems unable to extricate herself, or perhaps unwilling to do that. At the same time, as the state arises, it appears that in many ways the state seems to be more efficient at doing things, because remember, church officials were often bureaucrats as well, like Bishop Nazarali was speaking about, and the state seemed to be more efficient and quicker to respond to the needs of the poor. It's a problem still with us today. You can see how that still is a tension today. The state began to do more and more of what the church did, partially because on philosophical grounds people wanted to do that, partially because the church had abdicated. Simply, it was too slow to take care of the needs of the people around them. Furthermore, the reformers and the Roman Catholics, they all are turning to the state to help them foster their particular view of Christianity. Luther does this with the princes. The Roman Catholic Church does this. Virtually all of the reformers do this, maybe with the exception of the Anabaptists. And so the question is, how in Europe are we going to get all these antagonistic Christian cultures together? The solution that was adopted in the modern world, in liberal Western states, was to privatize religion. So we're not going to get rid of religion. We're not trying to get rid of God or religion or the church, but it's going to become more and more privatized. It's your own personal religious belief, and the state is going to protect your right to that religion. And that's kind of what we have today. The basis for society, therefore, gradually becomes not the church, not God's truth, but objective reason, science, and these things that put us on a more neutral, objective ground, because it is a way for Christians to get together when before they were fighting one another. But it sets in motion, you can see, all the things we see today. Now, America is an interesting phenomenon. It's a stumbling block in many ways for sociologists of religion because it's got such a unique origin compared to other countries that it ends up being just different in the way it plays itself out. That's one of the criticisms of Rodney Stark's work is that he's relying too much upon the American experience to generalize to all nations. But I didn't get to go to the one about does America have a Christian origin or not, but does it? Is this a Christian nation? Kind of a loaded question, of course, but did we have a Christian founding of this country? He's shaking his head no. What do you think? Michael's going like this. That's kind of a good answer. I mean, that's about the best I can do. I'm kind of wiggling my hand in a wishy-washy way for those who are listening, right? Now, if you look at each of the individual colonies, most of them were established with specifically Christian reasons. If you look at the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, for example, it's quite clear they wanted to establish the gospel in a Christian nation. Now, something funny happens in the Constitution, however. There are three ways in which there is really a sort of revolution, not politically so much, but religiously, and in terms of Christendom. The first is that there is no establishment of religion, which means you have established religious pluralism. No one church is going to be dominant. Now, in the situation of the late 18th century, that means no Christian denomination is going to be dominant. When the culture changes and becomes multi-faith, not just multi-denominational, then that means that you have religious pluralism, not only a small spectrum of Christians, but now it doesn't speak about the Christian religion specifically, does it? It's freedom, it's no establishment of any religion, not Islam, not Christianity even. There is no religious oath test. What's a religious oath test? A religious oath test. If you want to hold public office, you had to swear that you upheld the creed. That's abolished. So you can see how there's this decoupling in the United States of church and state. Not just the later statement by Jefferson about the separation of church and state, which doesn't even mean what he meant, what it means today, but it's there from the beginning. Furthermore, there's freedom of religion, which again institutionalizes a kind of pluralism. And it allows for competition. And it's no wonder that people love studying America in the 19th century because it's the cradle of many sects and heretical groups. It just spawns, for some reason, New York State especially. It's kind of the epicenter. So much comes out of there originally. I'm not sure why, but it does. People suspect it's because it's the burnt over district. That is, people who've been Christian and they become liberalized, and it really spawns all these kinds of heresies. Well, to make matters worse, there is the issue of changing morality. One way to solve these problems of religious wars and preserving peace is, like I said, to privatize religion. And so you build a society not on a common religion, but on a common morality. Because the idea is this, Christian morality can unite us because up until pretty recently, right, even people who weren't Christians in America had more or less a Christian morality. That's why this has blindsided us, because people who weren't Christians still shared a moral worldview, because it's what we were built upon. And it's relatively safe, because you can talk about things you've got in common without understanding the roots of it. The idea is that theology divides, so if we talk less about theology, more about morality, we'll be on safe ground. This is exactly what the church does theologically. It's the rise of what's called moralism. That is the idea that Christianity is reduced, not to dogma, but simply to practice or behavior. So you're a Christian if you're generally a good citizen, generally behave yourself in public. And that's, you see a lot of that language, don't you? You see virtue, not necessarily in the Christian sense, but in the kind of civic virtue. If everyone just kind of is a good citizen. So you have this scandalous deist, Benjamin Franklin, who is publicly a good, virtuous man. And that's all that's required to hold a culture together. So what happens is that by appealing to political leaders for reform or for protection, as the reformers did, the idea develops that the state exists for the highest good. That is, though the state gives you rights and it's going to protect you for the common good, based on a common morality which was safely assumed to be Christian until very, very recently. Slowly but surely, though, this notion of the common good was for human beings to practice and control the virtues necessary for society. But then that begins to fade away. That's just a stepping stone to what we've got now. Now the view is that the highest good of the state is still to protect something, But what it protects is your individual right to pursue whatever you want without any limit. The one limit is that is, as long as you don't do any obvious harm or legal harm to somebody else, you can do whatever you want. So you can see how there's, these things happen by degrees. We make mistakes as Christians, and years later we pay the consequences for that. And therefore, morality ultimately becomes individualized, privatized, and relativized. That's where we are at today. You can have your own morality, but it has no claims on me. It has nothing to do with me, which used to be, there used to be a sort of kind of neutrality. Now it's that's not good enough. Now, the idea is we have to change our morality to fit the public morality, which is no longer anywhere near a Christian one. There's also the issue of consumerism and capitalism. It's no, there's no denying that the world is material. People are better in a material way than they've ever been before. We may complain about things that hurt our pocketbook, but we're living in this incredibly golden age if you just looked at material prosperity. Sometimes people think of economics as being the zero-sum game. There's a fixed amount of wealth, and if the wealthy get wealthy, then they must have done it by the poor. And I like to, again, I like numbers. There are about a quarter billion people in the moment in the world at the time of the Roman Empire, time of Christ, 250 million people. 7 billion people today, so 28 times as many people. On average, is the average person today wealthy or poor? Should be 28 times poorer than then, right? We've got 28 times more people. Average person today is far wealthier. And not just in terms of dollars. I'm much wealthier than Henry VIII. You know, with the push of a button, I can call up any of 1,000 different orchestras, play any music I want any time. I can fly across the world in several hours. You can't do any of that. I can kill the germs that kill me before they, you know, you can't do any of that stuff. We all live like kings, we just don't think we do because we're looking at the Donald Trumps of the world, not politically, I mean, but financially, and saying, I'm poor. We're not. We're fabulously rich. I'm in the top 1% historically. In terms of America, I got kind of an average, you know, income. In terms of worldwide and historically, I'm a king. We just don't realize it. Now, so that part's undeniable. But there's a temptation, isn't there? Going back to Israel, going back to the garden, to have your head turned by that material success and say, well, we've got this for ourselves, or the scientific worldview has gotten this for us, or the free market economy has gotten for this rather than God. Also, it's safer, right? If you have a lot of stuff to protect, and everybody has a lot of stuff to protect, you're less willing to kind of go to war to lose it, right? You're pretty comfortable, right? You can fight wars, you can afford to fight these very expensive wars, because it doesn't really touch you that much sometimes, does it? You know, the wars we've been involved in recently, we may care about it and we have political views, but in terms of a lot of things, it doesn't make the practical difference that wars used to make to people, where you have just tons and tons of sons coming home in body bags. We haven't seen that at least since Vietnam, really, not on any large scale. And so somebody talked about that it's better to shop than to war. We've discovered it's better to shop than to war. It doesn't mean we love God anymore, it's just that it's safer, it's better materially. This leads to the idea of what I call shopping for God. You've all experienced this, that even Christians are susceptible to this. That instead of saying, well, here is God, and how he's revealed himself, here's how he's come to me in this God-givenness of the church, and the word, and ministers, and sacraments, and all that, I can pick and choose what I want. So, when I choose God or a church, often we choose that based on what? Not based on, is this really what the scripture says? Is this really what the church has always taught? What are the ways in which we choose our churches today? Comfort? Convenience? What's that?
Like-mindedness,
right? It gets back to comfort. This guy's a good preacher, his personality, or whatever it might be. I found that even with an Anglicanism, we don't really accept it in its totality as this is a comprehensive kind of coherent way of being a Christian. But I like it because of this, but then I also want to keep that from that tradition and this and that. You know, not that everybody's going to necessarily be called upon to figure this all out, but we're very impressionistic, we're very fragmentary. We have in our culture unprecedented choice, and choice is a good thing, but when you don't know how to use it, when you can't discern what's good from evil, choice means I have the choice to think I'm a black teenage woman, right? I'm going to be a real minority. I've decided that I'm going to determine I'm a minority of every possible stripe, and you can't tell me I'm not. I also decided yesterday, listening to Father Hauser's lecture, that I believe myself to be the Pope. Now, I know you may not accept that, but since I feel like I am, you have no right to deny that. So, now you've got to listen to me, right? I'm fearing the fact that there's going to be a bunch of popes, though, if I do that. You know, to make the Middle Ages look tame in comparison, because everyone's going to want to be a pope. But let me move on to education just briefly. We're keenly aware of where that's gone, but it's worse than we think. It's not just that we have people teaching things that are not Christian and so on, but we've taken education out of the hands of the church. From the very beginning, education was always in the church. And universities are Christian institutions, but relatively quickly, we developed this idea of freedom of thought, that the faculty somehow are insulated from the world outside, they're insulated from the church, they have their kind of own turf. When you do that, then the seminaries, the universities drift. I am happy to say that Cranmer House is a little bit tyrannical. That is, I do not have liberty of thought. Every year they make me sign this statement saying I believe in the scriptures and the prayer book and the 39 articles. And I can't teach if I don't sign that. Now, I could be a hypocrite, but I'm not. But they made me sign that, and I'm glad. I don't find that binding. I find that liberating. Because that means that I and the other faculty and students are all on the same page. I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe that stuff. Theology is demoted from being the queen of sciences, it's a cornerstone that makes everything integrated into a study of God, to being relegated to one study, to now being completely forbidden. Most Christians have accepted the public schools as a good place to send their kids, because I'm going to the good one, right? I'm going to the good public school. I'm going to move because there's a good school district. What does that mean? We don't even know what the ends of education are anymore. We don't know. We don't know what the meaning of college is anymore. It used to be to train the mind, to train to think. Then it used to be so you get a good job. Now, even that narrative is undermined. So why do we send our kids to college? I know why. It's to be secularized, right? Because you spend 4 years going out to a secular world, detached from your Christian home, from your Christian family, and everything that ever connected you to God, and you think you're going to come out safely, right? We do that. And even in terms of Christian education, we don't really understand very well what the goal is. There are other factors as well, but I want to get to the kind of payoff, which is that where are we going? What's the hope for the future? Because there is hope. I'm really a very optimistic person. I read all this, and history has made me more optimistic than ever, because I see anywhere I go in history, anywhere I go geographically, anywhere I go up and down the timeline, spin a globe, go to any country, and it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. The church has been in far worse things than we are now. So first of all, never give up hope, because we have Christ, the hope of glory. That's exactly what we can't do. Secondly, there's no golden age, which is very liberating. So instead of this, what I consider to be almost a mortal sin of comparing oneself to somebody else, I used to be bad at that, right? If you compare our culture to somebody else and say, oh, there's the golden age, poor us, you can't win, right? You're also probably not very historically informed, because that golden age was maybe it was the time of the church fathers and all the great church councils. Oh, you mean like where the heretics almost took over the complete East? Was that the golden age, or was it the Reformation, where people were killing each other over the faith? And there's no golden age. And yet it's always golden, because Christ is with us. God is in his heaven. The church has been through far, far worse. It doesn't mean persecution is not coming our way. I believe it is creeping, very slowly, at least in America. But we've been through so much worse. And I don't think that, by the way, persecution is an unmitigated good. I've revised that theory in my head too, because in some cases it's a bad thing for the church. But the church has survived it and often thrived through it. Learn the lessons of history. That is, that a lot of, you can see this trend towards secularization. A lot of it is what Father Hauser was saying in the sermon this morning. Judgment begins with the house of God. If it was a Christian culture, in many ways the West was, and these things happened, it was not the Voltaires or the atheists coming in from the outside and defeating us. Rome was not defeated from without before first it was defeated from within. It's when the church gives up what it has always taught and believed in these various ways that we are susceptible to being overcome by the forces of secularism. We've done this to ourselves. Remember, if secularism is the erosion of a religious worldview, it's Christians, it's under our watch. It's when we had the keys to the kingdom, it's when we were in charge of the state that we allowed this to happen. We made this happen. Which means there may be a hope for us re-envisioning things in the future. So the way to do that is the answer to everything, and that is to simply be the church. Follow the commandments of God. Do what you're supposed to do. Back in the 1830s, when the Church of England was under a lot of crisis, because in 1832 they had the reform laws where they allowed members of Parliament to allow people to be members of Parliament who were not Anglicans. Bishop Nasr Ali referred to this a little bit. That meant that since there's such a close relationship between church and state, that now people who are in Parliament can decide, oh, we don't need those bishoprics in Ireland anymore. People who are not Anglicans can tell the Church of England what to do. It gets worse, because it's not just you let in Roman Catholics. Eventually, you have to let in atheists, which is the state today. So there was this crisis. At that time, John Keeper, one of my personal heroes, he said, you know, the answer to this is what? He said, the answer for me as a parochial priest is to go out and serve my people in love in the name of Christ. So get up and do morning prayer every day, do evening prayer, have the whole Eucharist every week, go out and visit my people, teach them to love God and neighbor, and just all the things you're supposed to do. That's always the answer. If we did that, then I think it would be a different world. All those criticisms leveled against us as Christians. What can somebody say when we go out and we minister in love? They can still hate Christ. They can still not like what we have to say. They can still hate our guts. But what can they say honestly if we're at the forefront of social justice and poverty relief and all these things that we're not so good at sometimes? We should reclaim and joyfully manifest the sacramental worldview, which the prayer book system of the Rule of Life allows us to do. We have sanctified time. We have feasts and festivals and times of fasting. We do it together. We read the scriptures together. We live together. If we do that, then that's kind of the answer. You know, it's above my pay grade because I'm not really the Pope. I can't really tell the whole church what to do. I'm lucky if I can control myself and my children and have some influence in my parish and school. That's enough of a world that God's given me. If I do that faithfully, then that is my part in this. That is the solution. If we all did that as parishes, diocese churches, that's the answer. That means, though, being willing to submit to church authority. No more of this individual American religion. That's not what religion's about. It's a common thing. In fact, religion itself is about binding oneself to another. Humans are inescapably social, being made in the image of God. And then finally, don't be catechized by the culture. That is, especially for those of us who are parents and involved in Christian education, don't let your kids be formed by the world. They have to be in the world, but not of it. And it takes everything, the church, the Christian school, the Christian family, to do that. So I wanted to leave a little time for any questions or comments. Yes, Michael.
So the result of nominalism and all that is the loss of secularism.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's probably the most important thing that you say was regaining that. So how much time, energy, focus, attention should sacramental churches like the Anglican Church pay or apply towards the rest of the Christian brothers and sisters who maybe are in other traditions that's the furthest thing from? I mean, like in our church, mm-hmm. and maybe this is the same a lot, most of our people have come from, and I've come from, other backgrounds. So how much are you focusing on just planting liturgical churches versus how do you engage the Christian culture?
Well, that's a big question. I think it's the right question, or it's one of the right questions, but I think we've got to be doing a lot of things at the same time. It's not either or. The first thing, though, I think, is really to have a clear sense of our own identity. But you can't do that exclusively, and I think, you know, a lot of us have come into Anglicanism from the outside. Virtually all the people I've met, very few people are cradle Anglicans that I've come across in the REC. So a lot of us are struggling to know who we are. And I think you've got to do that first, but not exclusively, because you could do that, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and I've got a PhD in it, and I'm still like in kindergarten. You know, there's so much more to learn. So you have to do that simultaneously, but that is first, and I think that the REC does a pretty good job of understanding who she is and what it means to be an Anglican Christian in particular, to live out the life of Christ in that way. But at the same time, then, we've got to live that out, not just as an ideal, but at the parochial, diocesan, national level. And within the ACNA as much as possible. We need to have ecumenical partnerships. But then, this is what Bishop Nazar Ali was talking about, that I think that, frankly, the REC may not be as good at, being cross-cultural. And that doesn't just mean going out to blacks or Hispanics or people who are not like us ethnically, but it also means, I think, associating with other Christians that we may not naturally choose to do. And how you do that as a parish, I think we've got to kind of figure out together. Personally, I think it's, you know, it's how you do evangelism. You get to know people. All the research, and you look at the biblical data and how people come to know Christ, or anybody, how they come into faith, is by being associated with people who are like that. So you call them in. You strike up these friendships. If you have Christian friends, talk to them about these things. Not because you're trying to proselytize them to Chapel of the Cross, but because you care about them and you think this is true. I mean, that's why I'm an Anglican. If I thought there was something better, I would be there. So naturally, I care about these things passionately. I'm going to tell people, hey, this is why we do this, you know, and this is. I see this in the Bible. We have the Bible in common. Oh, here's another one. Everybody wants to be the early church. I haven't met a Christian or a church that doesn't think we're like the early church. Great, let's go read some stuff from the early church and see what it was like. You know, so building those bridges, though, but you can't just impose from the outside and say, here, let me enlighten you. We've done that. It doesn't work. So you build those relationships, and then you naturally say, hey, why don't you come to something here and see, you know, see what you think? And you know, so but it's, you do have to look outward to do that, and that's what love does, right? It has to look at the other, not self. And so, but not exclusively, because you love neighbor as self. So to me, it's not an either or. They both happen at the same time, and they're both mutually reinforcing. But it's a really good question, because without that question, then it's easy to become insular, like Bishop Nasrallah was talking about. Any other questions or comments?
When you think of, I guess, maybe the rise of the internet and a lot of those communications that now a lot of people who are maybe like minority now have this big voice, and kind of coinciding with the decline of at least public education, or critical thinking is not really taught a lot. So I was kind of like, what do you think of that that's kind of maybe contributing to
Well, I think all those forces have been in place for a long time. I think in many ways it accelerates it, because if the answer is to embody the sacramental worldview and reconnect God to His creation and see God in the creation, then virtual reality of various forms, social media is disembodying and it's disincarnating. And but on the other hand, I'm very conscious of that any of these things are tools. They're technologies. Technology is in itself neutral. So what we do with it. So I think there are responsible uses for all of these things. So rather than saying, let's not be engaged in these kinds of things at all, or let's just let our kids and ourselves do the same thing that the pagans do with that, isn't it possible, and wouldn't it be more likely to be the case, that we need to work out best practice? How does a Christian ethically engage with Facebook? How does the Christian ethically engage with texting? I mean, it's simple things like, you know, and I'm not seeing a lot of that here, I'm proud to say, for the young people. Oh, let me get this, or just, you know, every minute, right? Resist the tyranny to say that, hey, if I don't respond to this text in 1 minute, then my friends are going to think I hate them or I'm dead, right? That's what people say. So resist that. If I'm talking to him because he's here in my presence, talk to him. Maybe he's not my favorite person in the world. I said maybe. Second favorite. No, it's, I don't know you well enough for you to be a favorite. But does that make a difference? I'm supposed to love. I love him. Now, not picking and choosing. Oh, this person I really care more about. What does that say to you? What does it say about Christ? Can you imagine Jesus doing that? What would Jesus do? Oh, he'd answer the text and ignore the person in front of him. Right? So, I mean, simple things like that I've not seen a lot written on. There is stuff written about it. So I don't think we need to be afraid of it, but we sure better think about it and pray about it more than we have, instead of just doing it. And that's one of the hardest ones, because it's so systemic and so invisible that's what I meant by kind of these cultural liturgies. We have to resist doing that the way other people do, but we can't just escape it. It is the modern world. The church can use it. The analogy is the printing press. Printing press unleashed a Pandora's box of all sorts of things that aren't so good, but the church hopped on really quickly. It wouldn't have been a Reformation if that hadn't happened first. So use it responsibly. Thanks. I think we are probably out of time.